You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 257. This is Features Editor John Gentile. Listen, we got a super jam-packed episode for you today. We're going to be talking about the Ramones, because we love the Ramones. This is Punk News Podcast. We're going to be talking about Public Image / Johnny Rotten, because this is the Punk News Podcast. We're going to be talking about some pretty depressing, some pretty sad things as well. But we're going to wrap it up. We're going to keep it nice and happy. We're going to tie this package on up with an interview with the guys from the AFAT Rec documentary. Interview hosted mainly by Ricky Franco. That's Ricky Franco right there. Staff writer, reviews writer, interviewer. Ricky Franco, what's happening, man?
Nothing. Just excited for that interview. It's going to be really good.
Did you just compliment your own interview?
No, I said I'm really excited for the interview.
You said it's going to be really good. That's what you said, Ricky.
Well, I think it's going. I think it will be. I think the documentary is going to be really good. That's what I meant to say.
Go ahead, Ricky.
All right. You have to be kind of under a rock to kind of not know what the Fat Wreck documentary is. So I'm really excited for it. So stick around for the interview.
Well, speaking of a guy that is not under a rock, but a guy that is really good, we are also here with managing editor Adam White, way up there in Canada. Adam White, the theme music, that's Nightbirds. Have you heard that banging new Nightbirds track?
I haven't, but I'm super aware of it. It's one of these things that I saw, on my device that I carry around that allows me to access the internet. And I was not in a place where I could actually listen to it. So I'm aware that it is out there, and recording this show is preventing me from listening to it.
Can I just say that track is fucking awesome.
Listen, people, if you like the Nightbirds,
it's so good.
I'm wearing my Nightbird shirt right now. That's how good it is. And just in case you're wondering, once again, for 2 weeks in a row, I'm outside Panera recording this Punk News podcast, because I'm still out here in Harrisburg doing grown-up stuff. And actually, I'm not even in Harrisburg. I'm in Mechanicsburg. I'm next to the Panera, the Ross Dress for Less, and the Target. So listen, you'll have to excuse my agitation and lack of audio quality. Let's get this kicked off. Adam White, maybe the very first punk rock band was in the news. I love talking about this band. What's happening with one of the most important bands in all of music?
Well, it's been 20 years since their final show, and it is a year after the death of their last original member. But hey, the Ramones are still making news, John. The Ramones are set to appear in the Archie Meets Ramones comic miniseries that is teaming up the teams from Riverdale with the seminal punk band from Queens. The comic is going to be co-written by Alex Segura, who wrote the Archie Meets Kiss comic, and Matthew Rosenberg, who's behind 12 Reasons to Die, and drawn by Giselle, one name. The likeness of the Ramones is that's all controlled by a company called Ramones Productions Inc. It's a company that was run by guitarist Johnny Ramone's wife Linda. They're the ones that actually licensed the band's image out to be in this comic. But this is a thing that's happening. The series is going to arrive at some point in 2016, part of the celebration of the Archie comics 75th anniversary, and which just coincides with the Ramones 40th. So this is an interesting piece of, I guess, merchandise, you could call it, that's coming out, an interesting collectible. It's teaming up two very, I guess, iconic slices of Americana, I guess, if you want to consider the Ramones that, but that's always been Archie's, you know, thing, hasn't it? John, what do you think of this? Is this just a product? Is this something for the Ramones estate to sell, or is this cool?
Well, first of all, I'll point out that fun fact. I know for a fact that Archie Comics' proofreader is a Punk News reader and a Punk News podcast listener.
Oh, how do you know these things?
because she requested me on Facebook, and lo and behold, I saw that. Well, her name is Jamie. I don't know if she wants her full name out there or not, but Jamie is the Archie Comics proofreader, and she's a big Punk News fan. So, that's kind of cool. But for this could have played in one of two ways. It could have played as crass commercialization, or it could have played as a quirky, fun, wacky project. I think this is a quirky, fun, wacky project, and that's because Archie is so unhip. He's back around to being hip again. Like in the 80s and 90s comic boom, nobody read Archie. It was considered a cliche and has been. But now, I guess maybe because we're in a quote postmodern world, or maybe because the world is so nasty, people kind of enjoy the simplicity and quaintness of Archie. And whoever owns Archie Comics, I forget who it is. It's maybe it is Archie Comics.
It's a comic called it's Archie Comic Productions. Yeah.
Yeah.
They've actually been having some fun with. They actually put out a Archie Meets Predator, which I really wanted to get, and I went to the comic book store, but they only had issue 2, not issue 1. So Archie gets chased by the Predator. So they're retaining the core values of Archie while, I guess, being a little meta about it or commenting on it. And so I think this is just Archie being so unhip that he's hip again, and it's just fun. It's enjoying simplicity, which is fitting for both Archie and the Ramones. Archie lines and Archie storylines and Archie drawings are very simple, very straightforward, very crisp, just like the Ramones sonically. And I think it's a fun match, and I think you can't be jaded about this. You can't say it's a cheap cash grab, because if the Ramones want to do a cheap cash grab, there's a lot of things they can make a lot more money on than Archie Comics. I just think this is fun.
Yeah, I mean, this is there is, and this is me putting on my comic nerd hat right now, which is one of the hats I wear but don't often talk about on here, is that Archie has undergone this weird renaissance in the past few years, where yeah, it went from something that nobody really seems to talk much about, and it was just, you know, it was the thing that was in the checkout of the supermarket, you know, along with, like, you know, candy bars and gum, and you know, it was something that was there for kids. It's now taken on this, I guess, this renewed sense of I guess artistic validity amongst comics people. And I don't know what exactly had caused this. I mean, I know that there's a really popular horror series that they have out right now called Afterlife with Archie that is, I guess, a little bit of a different thing than what you would suspect. But they just did this big relaunch of, I guess, the core Archie comic that's written by Mark Waid and drawn by Fiona Staples. And like, those are, you know, incredibly huge people in the comics world that, you know, are normally, you know, out there working for Marvel or DC or Image, doing, you know, things that are, I guess, more accepted as, I don't know, artistically relevant. Not to downplay, you know, Archie's longevity or anything like that. But yeah, so they're in the middle of this crazy renaissance, and they keep doing things that seem like more and more weird and daring. They had a big splash not a few years ago because they had a gay character named Kevin Keller that started appearing in the comics. I think there was like a marriage comic featuring him. They had some Death of Archie storyline that they did not too long ago.
Do you know why Archie got assassinated?
Why did Archie get assassinated?
Because he was protecting the gay character, Kevin, was that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, like somebody like hated gay people in the comic, so they tried to shoot Kevin, and Archie jumped in front of the bullet, which I just think is like the best thing ever. I mean, that's just hilarious.
Yeah, so like if you would have asked me, you know, at any point during my, you know, Marvel zombieism that I've always just kind of been inflicted with, is there some point in your life when like Archie Comics are going to be something that is going to be relevant for you as like a 30-year-old man to talk about? I would not have guessed, but here we are. So the Ramones are going to meet Archie in a year or so. It seems fitting to me. I don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been into like the comic thing, but this seems harmless. I think this might just be kind of like a fun thing. I don't think it doesn't seem like they're trying to go after like a punk like readership or anything like that. It's just kind of fun.
We're big money.
all right. So, Public Image Limited have released their first single for their upcoming LP. The song is called Double Trouble, and it will appear on What the World Needs Now, which will be out September 4th. Adam, talking about the Ramones. Now we're talking about Johnny Rotten.
I love talking about Pill, and I feel that just throughout the entire history of punk news, we haven't been able to talk about it, to talk about that band to the degree that we should have. And I don't know why there's this weird like modern punk rock person blind spot for the band, and I don't really know why.
And
even when, you know, we were in that slate where there was a whole bunch of bands that were coming out that were doing this post-punk, rhythmic based thing that became incredibly popular for a few years on Pitchfork and all the big music blogs, where they were just clearly aping Pill sounds, sometimes not even trying to hide it. I'm talking about when that big record from The Rapture came out, and they were Pitchfork's Band of the Year, and whatever their song, what was the name of the damn song? The song was House of Jealous Lovers was the song that was like the big hit that they had. And like that song was a direct rip of like death disco, I think. And even then, when it was the hipster zeitgeist to like that kind of music, no one really talked about Pill. And I don't know why. I'm not sure. There's this aversion to talking about Johnny Rotten that the whole world has.
Why, Adam? It's because he's too unique. Johnny Rotten does not follow the crowd, whereas very hip music is generally people following the crowd, and Johnny Rotten does not follow the crowd.
Well, it's telling that like, the first comment on this article was someone being like, Sex Pistols, credit cards, butter ads, blah, and like barfing out all of the reasons why, you know, we're not supposed to acknowledge that Johnny Rotten has anything artistically valid to say anymore. So I don't know. Anyway, so here's a new Pill song. I know, as much as I'm singing the praises of this band right now, I'm not super hot on this track, only because my favorite Public Image Limited songs are ones where they're doing something long and rhythmic and either super melodic or super droning. Like, I like the band when they're being weird. And this isn't super weird. It's actually Johnny being a little bit more aggressive than I would tend to think with a lot of Pill stuff these days. So, you know, it's cool. I'm down with it, but you know, I want to hear on this record where they do like, you know, 6 minutes of weirdness. That's what I want.
You know, I got to disagree, Adam. Usually I'm going for the weirder tracks and you want kind of, you know, the garage rock or spitzy kind of stuff. I love this track, Adam. This might be, I'm not being funny or cute or anything. This might be like my favorite Pill song ever. I love this track. I love how hard and clean and sharp the riff is, and I love how aggressive and snappy and mean Johnny, but he's mean, but he's got that kind of jokester attitude to him that he portrays on this track. Apparently the track is about him and his wife fighting about the toilet, although you can't always believe Johnny Rotten either, but the point is people are like, oh, Johnny Rotten sells butter, you know, Johnny Rotten, there's Sex Pistols credit cards, which I don't even know if Johnny Rotten has anything to do with. Put your money where your mouth is. Johnny Rotten has this track is bang, and it's hard, and it's aggressive, and it's crazy. This is what punk rock should be. It's weird. It's weird-ish. And I love it. I think Johnny Rotten is one of the greatest minds of music, certainly one of the greatest minds of punk rock music. Adam, I love this track. If the whole album was like this with a little bit of variation, I would absolutely love this album. I think this track is awesome.
Oh, see, you've got me hyped up to go back and re-listen to this just to see that.
I love this track.
I was struck by exactly what you said, that like it is super clean. It is super punchy, right? Like right out the gate. And I think that I have this mental setup that when I go and I listen to a new Pill track, like I don't want the song that sounds like you know, like Public Image. I want the song that sounds like Flowers of Romance or something weird, right? So I gotta go back and listen to this. But I'm looking forward to this. I don't remember being all that enthused by One Drop and the music was on the previous LP that was out. None of it seemed to work that much for me, but you know, I'm down for more. I like hearing new stuff from John Lydon, whether it's his writing, and I haven't picked up the new autobiography that he had that came out. But I'm a
huge
yeah, but I'm a huge fan of No Irish, No Blacks, No Dogs, which was the one that he put out before that. It's incredibly well written and incredibly interesting. So I like consuming this guy's output, and this is more good stuff from him. So yeah, new Pill track. Go listen to it unless you're, you know, interested in crowdfunding a Sum 41 record or anything like that. But we'll talk about that later. John, we got to seg into like the worst thing ever now.
This is bad, man. This is bad news. All right. And actually, I encourage the listeners to listen to our previous discussion on Kim Fowley. Kim Fowley died about 6 months ago, I guess. We actually may have talked about this exact issue on the Punk News podcast without knowing we were talking about this issue. It's eerie hearing us talk about this issue then before we knew what happened with this issue. And here's what happened with this issue. So everyone, or maybe Kim Fowley's a very, very famous record. He's deceased now. He's a very, very famous record producer. He actually started in the 50s doing a lot of novelty tracks. In the 60s, he did some bubblegum kind of stuff. And then in the early 70s, he's kind of one of the early founders of punk rock or proto-punk or glam punk, that kind of a thing. He's the guy that put the Runaways together. And of course, you know, the Runaways is Jackie Foxx. The Runaways is Joan Jett, Cherry Curie, Lita Ford. And the Runaways were, you know, an early punk band or even a proto-punk band. Well, recently, Jackie Foxx basically did an in-depth interview that was published at the Huffington Post. And in the in-depth interview, she described a very nasty, or I guess she described, and it, well, she allegedly said the following happened. Basically, she said that she was at a party with Runaways were there, a whole bunch of people were there, and what freaked me out is, like, they talked about how a lot of people there were, like, 13 and 14, which apparently, like, that was the scene in the 70s. Like, you would go to a drug party in L.A. or whatever, and people would be, like, 14, 15, 13, which seems impossible to me these days. But maybe this really does happen in, like, these L.A. – I've never been to, like, a crazy L.A. party. So maybe people are, like, 14 and 15 and doing drugs. So anyways – according to Jackie Foxx, she was at this party. Somebody gave her a whole bunch of Quaaludes, and she basically was awake but couldn't move. And then Kim Fowley took off his clothes and had sex with her, so raped her in front of everybody else, including in front of Joan Jett, including in front of Lita Ford, including in front of Cherry Curie. And people essentially didn't do anything. And apparently she said she got raped by Kim Fowley, and she's only felt comfortable about coming along now, coming out about it now. Kim Fowley is long since deceased. What was weird is when Kim Fowley was asked about this type of situation, he said, "In my mind, I never made love to." I'm going to pull the quote up while we talk about it. It was a really, really weird quote that I'll pull up in a moment. Part of the article tied in is when someone gets raped, how come people that are watching it or know about it don't do anything? And it focused a good deal on the psychology of that. And the interviewer – oh, how you like that? The link didn't work. The interviewer basically stated that – oh, here we go. I can pull it up right now. The interviewer basically stated that the reason that Jackie Foxx wanted to do this was basically to examine and talk about when someone gets raped, how come other people don't really do anything about it, which is a big issue. However, following this fairly explosive interview, both Joan Jett and Cherry Curie – at first Joan Jett said, Jackie Foxx can say what she wants to say. Those are her words, so not really confirming or denying anything. But then afterwards, when people kind of put some heat on both Joan Jett and Cherry Curie, they both said that the rape never actually happened, that Kim Fowley never had sex or raped or however you want to phrase it with Jackie Foxx, and then it just isn't true. So who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what happened? We will never know what happened. In a way, I feel as though Kim Fowley kind of buttered his own bread, if you will. Kim Fowley was famous for being weird. He was famous for being creepy, and he was famous for being in a pretty funky, kinky scene, you know? So did he do what Jackie Foxx is talking about? Maybe, maybe not, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised if he did, because, I mean, like, his whole character that he portrays is an exploiter. I mean, the whole concept of the Runaways is here's some underage girls that are going to sing sexual songs and wear sexual clothes. I mean, that's the whole thing, you know? So I would like to believe that it didn't happen just because I'd hate something that horrible to happen, but maybe it did. I don't, we'll never know. And I just hope those kinds of scenes aren't around anymore, but maybe they are. I really don't know. I mean, what can you say about it, Adam?
A lot of talk that has, assuming that this happened, and I'm going to just go with that as a premise for the rest of this discussion, but assuming this happened, there's been a lot of talk about like the bystander effect, which is a really famous psychological phenomenon, and you can go look that up, where you know, something horrible happens in front of you, but you know what, it's not you there to stop the horrible thing, you're in a crowd, and there's something about being in that crowd where you paralyze, and you just let it happen because everyone else is letting it happen, and everyone's too, I have no idea about psychology here, so I'm going to totally screw this up, but everyone is just too, you know, socially paralyzed to actually do anything about it, and then the crime takes place before anyone actually has the nerve to kind of break from the group and do something about it. Like, if that's what happened, then like, this is horrible for everyone. I mean, it's of course horrible for Jackie, as the victim here. Then it's horrible for, you know, all for the other girls that are in the band, mainly because if they were young, like, so how old would they have been at this time?
Oh, and actually, Adam, I don't want to jump on your coattails here,
yeah,
but people might be saying, how come Joan Jett didn't do anything? Because she was a 15-year-old girl.
Well, so that's what I'm getting at. Yeah, that's what I was looking for, right? You know what I mean? So you think about it. So let's say this happened in front of them. Joan Jett and the rest of the girls in the band are 15. They're in, you know, they're in this weird drug situation with a bunch of adults, and this happens. And let's say, you know, let's say the bystander effect holds true here, and they don't do anything about it. And they all just somehow go on with their lives and put this horrible thing, you know, out of mind or out of, you know, they keep going. And now it's back in all of their faces, and they've got to be confronted with it. And you have Jackie here being like, you know, again, assuming all that all this happened, in a way that she's being doubly victimized by this, because not only was she the original victim of this, but then she has to deal with the fact now that, you know, the other witnesses that actually saw the thing happened are denying that it happened, which is, you know, which is further victimizing of her. At the same point, you know, and of course it's not as bad for, you know, for Joan or Cherry or anyone as it would have been for her, but like, they're all now in this position where, you know, what's the best they can look out of this? I guess the best they can look like is they were like, you know, terrified teenagers that were, you know, caught in a really horrible situation. At the worst, they're, you know, potentially, I don't know, is that, John, you're the law, like, could they be legally culpable for not doing anything or not saying anything or not reporting, or are they an accomplice at that point?
Almost certainly not. In American law, you have no duty to other people if you don't put them in the dangerous situation, unless you're a guardian or have some sort of that kind of relationship. So, like, if you're walking down the street and somebody's getting mugged, you have no duty to do anything at all. And that's the way it's got to be.
Wasn't that the last episode of Seinfeld?
Yeah, but that would be completely unconstitutional.
Yeah. So, in any case, you have a lot of people now turning around and looking at Joan, looking at these people who now they are fully functioning adults, and you have people turning to them and saying that, like, why didn't you do anything? Like, this sort of makes you a horrible person. And at the same point, they may be, maybe not to the same degree, but they may be traumatized and fucked up by that whole experience as well. Like, this sucks for everyone. I mean, if he did it, you know, Kim Fowley is a real fucking monster for having done this. But like, man, like, this is just shit for everybody. Like, what good is there to come of any of this outside of maybe the truth coming to light?
Here's a quote, Ricky. I want you to respond to this quote. This is Kim Fowley's quote, and there's a lot to pick out of this quote. Fowley always denied any sexual impropriety with the members of the Runaways, including in a 2013 band biography where he stated, "They can talk about it until the cows come home, but in my mind, I didn't make love to anybody in the Runaways, nor did they make love to me." And my question is, if someone accused you of rape, wouldn't you just say, never, not true, completely untrue, false, that's a lie, rather than some weird, poetic, gothic phrasing?
Yeah, I mean, come on. I mean, I don't mean to sound, like, callous, but when I saw this article get posted, I was not that surprised that he was being accused of this. The guy in any of the stuff I've read other than this and video interviews like from the 70s and the way he was portrayed in the Runaways movie, you could see there was something up, like not that no one really spoke about, but you could see like there was something and he came off as kind of a creeper. I'm going to be honest. So
watch him in any interview. He is creepy, you know?
Yeah. So I mean, I'm not all that surprised that this has come out. I feel horrible for her. I'm a little bit disappointed in how Joan Jett kind of like flip-flopped on it a little bit. Not or like waffled, I think is more the term. Because I she's someone that would like, if this really happened, she would just be like right along with her, or maybe she didn't
see it. Don't know.
I don't know.
Joan Jett's very difficult to categorize. Very difficult. But actually, I think Joan Jett, let's assume Joan Jett's telling the truth. We don't know. Joan Jett says it didn't happen. So initially her statement was, Jackie Foxx can say what she wants. Those are her words, right? So if Joan Jett believes it didn't happen, Joan Jett's three options are the following. To say, no, she's lying. She's lying about rape. The classy move is to not say that, especially in Kim Fowler's case where he's dead. The classy move is just say, well, she can say what she wants. I'm not going to add to it, you know. She could lie and say, oh, I saw it, but there's no real reason to do that. Or she can do what she did initially and just said, well, I'll let Jackie speak for herself. I don't have anything really to add. So I think that's the classy, smart, feminist, protective stance to take, if you will.
Yeah, but if you see,
as opposed to saying, no, she's lying, when at this point it doesn't matter if she's lying or not.
Yeah, but I mean, if you see the article got updated, it says that she issued a statement that said, anyone who truly understands that if I was aware of a friend or bandmate being violated, I would not stand by when that happened.
Well,
I mean,
true.
Listen, who knows if she was on drugs when it happened? So maybe she really doesn't remember it.
No, but see, that's what I'm saying is at first she said, well, Jackie's words can stand for Jackie's words. I'm not going to add for it. And then people were like, Joan Jett, you're an asshole. How could you not save her or help her out in the situation? So then Joan Jett's back is against the wall. So Joan Jett has to protect herself, you see. So yeah, initially, right. Joan Jett, if Joan Jett really believes that Fox wasn't raped, then initially she's protecting or not attacking Fox. Only when her back is against the wall does she have to, I guess, quote, attack Fox, if you will. So I think Joan Jett, if Joan Jett is telling the truth, and I don't know, then Joan Jett did handle it basically as well as she could have, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, who knows if she even got, like, any prior notice. She probably, it sounds like she didn't get any prior notice, actually, that this was going to come out.
I don't think she did, you know.
Yeah, so, all right, well.
But I mean, then again, they're all 14, 15-year-old girls. Creepos are handing out drugs. It's a bad scene. You can't blame any of the girls for anything in the situation, you know?
The 70s in Los Angeles was not a great time, man. From what I'm told. And this was, I mean, you guys are wondering if, like, this was, like, if this happened on occasion or not. I think this was, especially Hollywood, this was fairly common, unfortunately.
Like a 13-year-old was at Alice Cooper's party in the article. A 13-year-old at Alice Cooper's party? Well, like, what is going on? Like, a 13-year-old is a little girl. I wonder if back then people treated, like, teenagers and even, like, preteens as older than they were. Like, that's weird, you know? Like, having a 13-year-old at your party? That's weird. But maybe back then people treated kids more as adults. I really don't know. That's just so weird. Anyway, you know what? Let's cleanse the palate. This is a sad story. No way to make any positive out of this story. This is sad. Let's cleanse the palate from a better time in L.A. You know, a little while ago we talked about Rick Wilder showing up on Ariel Pink's video. Rick Wilder was in the Mau Maus. And we play the track by the Mau Maus. Well, this is why used record stores are great. I was in the used record store. I came across this CD, $2, by this band called False Alarm. I flipped it over, and on it was the band False Alarm, which apparently Fat Mike of NoFX was briefly in the band in like 1982. Well, they broke up and they got back together and they recorded this album. And the second track of the album was a New York Dolls cover, Vietnamese Baby, with Rick Wilder of the Mau Maus on vocals. So this is a really neat, interesting track from L.A. This is a cool track. This is False Alarm with Rick Wilder on vocals, guest starring, covering the New York Dolls' Vietnamese Baby. Let's check it out. And we are back. Fellas, a lot of punk news kids are sad about this one. The Weaker Thans, Canadian darlings, acoustic darlings, if you will, have broken up. In a somewhat, I guess, unusual news post, here's what drummer Jason Tate said. He said, word is getting out that the Weaker Thans are done. Here's the song that we used to take the stage to for years. Bye Bye, and it was a John Coltrane song. And then also, it was confirmed by the band's Stephen Carroll as well. So it looks like the Weaker Thans are broken up. People were bummed out about this at Punk News. Adam White, the master of all things Canadian, are you bummed out about this? What do the Weaker Thans mean to you? Haven't they really been broken up for a long time?
See, I'm on the one hand, the Weaker Thans have been a remarkably important band in my life, and I mean they still are. Like I can reach my arm to the left and I have a framed copy of the tour poster from their 2004 tour sitting on the wall next to me. So the weaker thans are super important for all sorts of reasons, which I don't even think I really need to explain why this band is important to people. But I'm really of the opinion that this was not a... that this is a manufactured story, I guess. So the Weaker Thans are one of these bands that, almost like the Descendants on our past the past episode, they are incredibly slow between releases. They've always been slow to put out new things. Partly it's because some of the band members live in Toronto, some of them live in Winnipeg, and increasingly they all have other stuff to do. One of the members of the band is heavily involved in the Polaris Prize up here in Canada. John Kay, of course, is an artist in his own right that, when not even doing his solo stuff, he's involved in all sorts of arts projects and things in Winnipeg. This is a band that has been, at least for the past decade, not a full-time band. They're not a bunch of kids that are sitting around in a van. They're men that will come together, you know, every few years and do some recording. But, you know, those time spans were huge. So were there not, you know, confirmations from the band members that all kind of came to light because of some social media stuff within the past week that, oh yeah, we're done, then there wouldn't really be a story here, because the Weaker Thans being broken up this week is sort of the same as the Weaker Thans not being broken up this week. Like, they weren't doing anything one way or the other. And if the Weaker Thans come back and reunite in 3 years and release an album, it's exactly the same as the band not having announced a breakup and then just releasing an album 3 years from now. And no one would have batted an eye at that happening. So, you know, yes, on the one hand, it's too bad that they are not together anymore. This band is super important to me. On the other hand, it's not like they were doing anything. And so I'm haven't found it myself to get all that emotional about this. It's not like they were, you know, out there being road warriors and, you know, playing, you know, your town next week, and oh, now they're not because they blew up. It doesn't seem like that. I mean, I'm almost surprised that there was even an announcement. I mean, the band seemed just kind of happy to just not say they were doing stuff when they were not doing stuff. So, you know, and if you saw the way the story germinated, you know, one of the band members sort of made a comment to, I think it was CBC Radio 3 about it. And, you know, it was like an Instagram post that Radio 3 put up that kind of blew up into the whole story. And then one of the other guys pops over on Instagram or on Twitter and is just like, oh yeah, well, like, you know, yep, I guess the word's out that we're done. So, you know, yeah, sure. I guess it's, on the one hand, it doesn't bode well that we're getting another Weaker Thans record, and that kind of sucks. On the other hand, by the time the band changes their mind about this and does release a new record, it will be the same time frame if they broke up in the middle of it or not. Like, does that make any sense, what I'm trying to put out there? Like,
yeah. Basically, yeah. If they didn't announce anything, then it would have just been another record. But now that they're, quote, broken up, they put something out. It's the big reunion record, and they're back.
Yeah, I guess.
Honestly, I think there's bad blood in this band. It's a weird way to announce a breakup. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean,
it was fairly abrupt.
I think, like, to me, it feels like, and I could totally be wrong about this, but, like, to me, it almost feels like they weren't intending to make a public breakup. They were just going to, you know, more or less not be a band, but not make any noise about this fact. And then one of the members did. So then the rest of the guys are like, all right, I guess we're in the news this week. And I don't think it was any of their intention to, like, make news out of this.
What would they expect, though?
Well, I just think they would have just expected just to do what they were doing last week, which was nothing, but not making an announcement about it, you know?
Yeah, but if they make an announcement, there's going to be some sort of reaction.
Well, I don't know. That's what I think. I don't think the band, like, as a collective, intended for there to be any announcement. I think one of the band members, in talking to the press, you know, for whatever reason, let it slip that, like, oh yeah, like, watch. I mean, the reason one of them was talking to the press was CBC Radio 3, CBC Music. They posted this list of like the top 100 Canadian bands that they put on their website. It's a fucking stupid list. Don't get me started on the list. It's infuriating to me. But anyways, I think as part of doing this, they went to various members of other Canadian bands and asked them to comment on the bands that are in the list. So I just think that they were in conversation with some Weaker Thans guys, and the Weaker Thans were, of course, on the list. And it just, you know, it came out from whoever they were from. I guess, I don't know if it was Jason that they were talking to or Steve, but whoever they were talking to, it kind of came out that, like, oh yeah, we're not a band anymore. And then it was like the news kind of emerged in a, holy shit, the Weaker Thans aren't together. One of them just said it. It's not like the band announced it. So, yeah, to me, it's a weird story. And because the story emerged that way, it hasn't felt like one that I can get overly worked up about. Like, I got to imagine that, like, John Sampson right now is sitting there in his log cabin somewhere in the Manitoba wilderness, and you know, his old-fashioned phone is ringing off the hook, and he's just like, ugh, like, this was not what I intended to do this week.
Listen, Adam or Ricky, maybe you could explain this to me. Like, why is the punk rock community embraced this band so much? I've seen this band live, and it's very, I mean, it's folk music. It's essentially Cat Stevens or Steely Dan or something. I mean, it's just because of the John K. Sampson connection. Why has this come to represent punk? And I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean, honestly, why is this punk?
Well, you know, I mean,
not at all?
You know, I had the same questions when I first heard this band too. I'm with you, John. I don't know, and I never, like, I've listened to this band a few times throughout the past few years, and it just didn't really do anything for me. So I guess, Adam, it's up to you, man.
It's entirely just based on the community that they came from. I mean, there's a lot of bands out there that do things that are of a similar stripe to what the Weaker Thans do. I think more so now than before. But there's this current that exists in Canadian music, I think, in particular, where, you know, at some point you get old and you want to become like Neil Young and Crazy Horse. Right. So that tends to happen to a lot of bands.
Not John Lydon. John Lydon gets nastier and more aggressive. And that's why I love him.
John Lydon isn't Canadian. So let me explain. that is a thing that happens with a lot of bands, is that they go kind of go down that road. I mean, my beloved Constantines live on that line. But what happened was that when the Weaker Thans emerged, they had the connection in that, you know, John was a member of Propagandhi. So he was from this skate punk band that was singing, you know, playing like incredibly political, incredibly in your face music. And he was the weird one in the band that was playing kind of the weird, a little bit not, you know, a little bit less aggressive, a little bit more melodic stuff that was on Propagandhi records. But, you know, resonated with a lot of people. A lot of people like that still. So he was from that. He was from that scene. So when Follow emerged, the first Weaker Thans record, and people started hearing that, you know, he had a lot of people that were from the punk rock audience that were hearing, you know, maybe for the first time hearing that kind of stuff. Or at least in my case, you know, it was one of my first exposures to, let's say, music of that kind that was like from someone that I would consider a peer, because he's not, but like from someone that's one of my bands, right? Like one of the people that I follow in my kind of like epiphat life, is going down that road. And this was way before any of the, you know, like we make a lot of jokes about like the Chuck Reagan and the reunion tour stuff right now, where like all the punk frontmen are going out there and, you know, doing solo acoustic things. But like when
not John Lydon,
yes, I love, right? But when the Weaker Thans started doing that, they took a lot of people from the punk scene and brought them down this road where they were all listening to Propagandhi, because Propagandhi was like in your face and political and fast. And the early Weaker Thans records were also very political, but they were incredibly personal. And it was like taking that same that same level of like political frustration and, you know, lefty punk outrage, and then, but then filtering it through this, you know, almost like just like disarmingly softness, this weaker, you know, thing.
Would you say it's weaker than normal punk?
Absolutely, right? And I think that I've got to imagine that the band's name is a little bit of a tribute to that kind of fact, because they came from that scene. Like, their early records in the States were, well, I mean, in the States, they wrote on Sub City, on the record, that the label that was like the political sub-label of Hopeless Records. In Canada, they were on G7 Welcoming Committee, so they were putting out stuff, you know, on the crazy propagandy super political leftist label that was, you know, run as a collective out of Winnipeg for a while. So, you know, they were from that scene, and they brought a lot of people, you know, from that scene along with them. I don't think that you can look at these bands like in complete isolation from the scenes that they came from, because, you know, if you were to, you know, start from nothing and start playing music that sounded like this, you're not necessarily going to appeal to a bunch of punk rock people. But you know, if you start from that scene, you go down that road, then people go down that road with you. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just, you know, that's how they gained the audience that they did. And for better or worse, like a lot of bands that we seem to talk about on here, a lot of people followed them down that road and then started their own bands, skipping over the, you know, years of playing skate punk to kind of get there. And, you know, whether that's your cup of tea is an entirely different question.
Why did people embrace John K. Samson and his softer, gentler music, but they did not embrace – why did the punk community embrace John K. Samson and his softer, gentler music, but they did not embrace John Lydon and his more spastic, more crazy music?
I think that – well, there is so much – there's so much, I guess – like, scene politics isn't even the right thing. There is the right thing to say. There is so much, like, general – music navel gazing wrapped up in the Sex Pistols and what happened to the Sex Pistols and the legacy of the Sex Pistols that I don't know. I don't feel like I can blame any one person for having a weird opinion of John Lydon. It's like,
but I want to.
Oh no. I mean, like, I want to, but like, I get why he is such a loaded personality. Like, why it's such a loaded question. Him. Right. And that's cool. I mean, the thing is, and John, I mean, it's not your cup of tea, but the weaker than stuff, for what it is, it's all really good. I mean, he's a great lyricist. He's a good songwriter. So it's not like he took people down this road of, you know, tepid music that was bad. It was down this road of like tepid music that was good. So if that's not the thing that you're into, that's cool. But I'm not going to.
Have I said one negative comment about the Weaker Thens on this podcast, Adam?
A few.
I haven't.
I have not.
I can sense your disdain right now in your head. There's like a Melvins record playing backwards because it's more discordant.
Well, honestly, I mean, that is my. I'm not gonna hate it. I know a lot of people love the Weaker Thens. It's not my thing, but, and this is maybe one thing I'll never understand. Maybe write and explain it to me, kids, at podcast at punknews.org. When you're sitting there and John K. Samson's guy's acoustic guitar and he's like, "I love cats. Cats are so nice." You know,
Cat song make me cry, I tell you.
And he's up there, and I'm like, you know what? I could see Buzz Osborne like playing like 10,000 watts, making nasty, like growling, heavy, screaming music. Why would I choose this over that? You know,
Can't you have both?
Well, you can, but I mean, you can have bologna and steak, but I'd rather just have two steaks, you know?
Like, our next headline is like, John Gentile has heart attack. All right,
two snakes.
So we're talking about the best Canadian bands ever. So we have to move to this last story that we have.
I just want to say I was the one I contributed this one, and I was like, I was laughing when I saw this. I couldn't believe it. But go ahead.
Okay, so here we go. As a disclaimer, Adam White does not think that this is one of the best Canadian bands ever, nor does he think it's in the top anything of the best Canadian bands ever. And furthermore, I think these guys now live in LA, so this is Ricky's problem. All right, so Sum 41, which, if you want to feel old, has a band that's been around for 19 years now. They have launched a fundraiser over at the Pledge Music crowdsourcing thing to fundraise their upcoming full length. It'll be their first since 2011's Screaming Bloody Murder. And, you know, at whatever point this band was relevant was much before that, because it's the first time you're actually hearing of that record. when was this band last have their big hit? When was it?
I mean, their heyday was like 2001 or two.
You know what? On 2000. So,
because like I remember being a kid and being like, hearing that song Motivation, like on K-Rock on the radio.
Yeah. Okay. So their album that broke was 2001's All Killer No Filler.
Yeah.
Before that, they had a record called Half Hour of Power that was out during that. They were one of those bands that was kind of trying to ape Blink-182's thing when Blink-182 was the band that everyone, you know, gave a lot of a shit about. Anyways, though, back to the story. So, the campaign to raise money for this new album, it's offering, you can go and you can purchase it in all sorts of formats, digital, a CD, vinyl, you know, all between, you know, $10 and $25. Or if you're an insane person, you can get one of these super esoteric things. Like, I'm gonna pull up the list here because some of the things that they're offering are bananas. And
can I? Okay.
I want to read one, and then you can read one.
Okay.
I think I'm gonna leave you the last one because I think it's super stupid. Too. So, you know, if you want to be one of the two people who could each choose to pay $5,216, you could get one of this guy's guitars. If you want to pay $3,000, they'll sell you a snare drum that they're going to use to record this new masterpiece. You know, $500, you can get like a 60-minute guitar lesson over Skype. And hell, I mean, like, you guys who listen to this show, like, you listen to us talk for an hour all the time and no one gives us $500, so you know, fuck you. So, but Ricky, what is the coup de grace here?
Oh, well, okay, so if you want I think, Adam, it sounds like you had different amounts because it's in Canadian, but here,
oh yes, okay,
for $5,000 American, you and one guest can join Derek, their lead singer, at a rock concert of his choosing in the Los Angeles area. Examples of upcoming shows include AC/DC, Foo Fighters, The Who, and that also, mind you, includes the download of the album. And
well, that's good.
Yeah, so at least you get that. And then, I mean, there's also, for $250, you can join Derek on a call for 15 whole minutes to talk about everything from guitars, recording, and anything Sum 41.
So for like $5,000, you could go see like The Who with Derek Weebly or whatever his name is here. Like, do you get to do a bunch of drugs?
Well, you know, I think he had he was in the press, I guess like a year or two ago, and he had some, like, he's sober now, I'm pretty sure. I think he almost died from alcohol.
No, his kidney shut down or something.
Something
like,
that.
In really, really, really bad shape for a while.
Yeah. Did either of you two watch the? And by the way, one of the $500 things is sold out. Hang on, let me see here. Oh, the join the band in the studio and watch the new music be recorded option is unfortunately all gone. So that was $500 you probably could save. What about the, did you guys watch the video for this?
No.
I did.
No.
It was just like, it was pretty much a, well, we're not sure what to do now after touring for so long kind of a thing. It doesn't say how much they've raised, but my question is, these guys want, first of all, there are only two original members left in this band. I know their drummer left.
Oh no! I gotta question the integrity of Sum 41 now. Oh God.
And so my other question is, why are they crowdsourcing this when aren't they like on Island Records or something?
Well, they definitely were. Or John, jump in.
Is this a publicity thing? you think?
I want to point out that the time span between now to Sum 41's first album is the same as the time span from Sum 41's first album to David Bowie's Diamond Dogs album. How does that make you feel? How does that make you feel?
That is the weirdest thing that you could bring up. But okay, that's
so anyway. So here's
how has culture changed between Half Hour of Power and now? Like, how do they leave music just shattered and rebuilt in their wake?
I'm just saying, is look how much change between Diamond Dogs and 1996 or 1995, and how much the music has changed between 1995 and now, you know. But anyways, I actually don't blame the band for crowdsourcing this at all, and here's why. They're charging $10 for a download, $15 for a CD, both very reasonable prices. The fact is I guess the idea of crowdsourcing used to be for people that didn't have any money, here's how they can raise money. But I think that idea is kind of gone now. I mean, essentially now crowdsourcing is a way to generate revenue for your product. And if we're talking about punk rock, the most punk rock thing is to put something out on your own album. So the fact that they're putting it out on their own album and I'm getting dirty looks from the Panera people. I'll put the chair back when I leave. I'm leaving in a few minutes. So anyways, the point is, the point is that the fact that they're finding a way to get a revenue stream and sell people records for $10 or $15, I can't hate them for that. You know, no one's paying money for records anymore. And so if that's what, you know, if that's the way that it takes to make a record, that's what they should do. The only people to blame are, the illegal downloaders and that kind of thing, because there's no money in music anymore. So $10, $15 for a record, that's a fair price. And this is how they're, selling a record for a fair price to people that want it. I see no problem at all with this. I think this is exactly what most bands should do. Why give your money to a label that's only going to give you half or a quarter of what's due to you when you can, make the money yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I can't deny that. And I mean, basically this is the patronage model of where you're going out and you're having, people actually, give you money to make art, before you make the art. And
well, I do have a problem with that, honestly.
Well, but I mean, what I wanted to get at though is that, like, I am curious what their goal was here for raising money. I guess it doesn't really say. This isn't quite like Kickstarter, this site, but there are bands where we would unquestionably say they're okay bands that or have used this exact system, like the Buzzcocks used this system for their last one. So I'm a little bit unsure if we should liken Pledge Music directly to Kickstarter, because it seems a little bit like, it's more of a replacement for, doing pre-orders and doing pre-sales than it is being like, a label won't give us money, so please give us money, right? I still want to make fun of it because Sum 41 is a horrible band, and I feel like as a Canadian, I was unduly, forced to be aware of them for most of my adult life, and I'm not happy about that.
Listen, here's a problem that I'm having right now with two bands, and I'm really not happy about that. For one band, I gave them a pretty good chunk of change a long time ago, and I still haven't received my thing, and, they're working on it. Another band, I'm pretty sure they're just going to take my money. So I'm in the situation where I'm a creditor to bands that I like, Like, what do you do about that? I mean, is there anything you just have to suck it up? Like, I don't, you can complain to Kickstarter, you can complain to Play Music and say, they're ripping me off. But then, like, Kickstarter asks the band, where's everybody's stuff? And then the band's agitated that you're bothering them or accusing them of ripping you off, but maybe they are ripping you off. You know what I mean? I hate that. I hate being in this position.
I have never funded music directly with one of these things. I know so many people that have, and they all have like that kind of story. I've funded I've done a ton of like books, and like to go back to my earlier nerd comments, like I've done like comics and stuff like that on Kickstarter where I've funded. All of that's come through, and I have this bookshelf full of things that's here now. I think the problem is that musicians, even the best of them, are flaky maniacs. Thanks. And I don't know how much money I would give them before they,
Well, Well, I didn't give anybody like $1,000 or $500, but I gave one band more than the price of a CD or a record, if you know what I'm saying. And it's not looking good, boys. I mean, what do you write us in the podcast at punknews.org. What would you do in that situation? I'm at a loss. I don't know what to do. I mean, do I just suck it up and lose my money? You know, I mean, I'd rather have the product that I paid for, but I don't know if I'm going to get that or not. Ricky, what do you think?
I'm actually, I don't know if I'm in the same situation yet, but I am waiting. I contributed to one Kickstarter campaign for a band that's putting out their first record. They're recording now. And it's been a while, and I'm starting to get a little worried, but then, but at least I've seen them be active. They're doing some shows in the area right now. I'd say like, if you don't get the stuff after a year, then I'd start really like considering like just talking to Kickstarter, because I mean, give them a certain amount of time, but like after a year, they said they have like if they talk about like deadlines and stuff like that on there, then I don't see the problem.
I mean, we're at like 30 months right now. And I sent one thing, and they're like, "Oh, it's coming." And that was like a year ago.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be a debt collector to not my favorite bands, but to bands I like. I don't want to be like, "Where's my stuff?" You know. Well, I mean, but I want my stuff. But I don't want to lose my money. But I don't want to be a dick. So I'm in an uncomfortable position.
If it were me, I would just assume that you're probably not going to get it. And when it does come, you'll be even more that much more surprised.
So you're just saying write it off, except that you got suckered is what you're saying, which might be the right move.
Not necessarily suckered. It's just like, you know what, you put your faith into them, and then you know for next time. Also, they're supposed to. I mean, Kickstarter also has like a feature where the band's supposed to update you on stuff.
Yeah,
and if they're not doing that, they're not doing that.
Nah. I mean, a lot of bands do that. Though. I've had other Kickstarters where the band didn't update it, and then you know, surprise, surprise, you get a cool CD in the mail or something.
But yeah.
I've got two bands right now that I'm pretty sure are burning me, you know. And one is like $15, sucks. The other is more than $15.
Yeah, the one I have is more than $15 too. But I know them, so I mean I hope.
Adam, any last words? Any advice as a businessman that runs his own business?
If the band's going to take longer than is reasonably expected to deliver on these things, then they have every avenue using these tools to be constantly doing something to sate your appetite, right? To be out there, to be talking to people, to be explaining where they are in the process, to be making all sorts of noise in lieu of the products coming out, to keep you at least confident that the product is not has not vanished. And if that's not, if they're not doing that, that's, you know, they're doing a poor job.
Well, I should add, I meant to point this out, is I saw one of the bands around town spending a lot of money, and I'm thinking, that's my money. You know what I mean? I'm buying your dinner, you know? So anyway, I don't know. I wonder what the kids have to say about this. What have you done in the situation? Did it work out for you? Ricky, play a song. How about that?
All right.
Does this band owe you any money that you've pledged to them, Ricky?
They don't,
Is this band in your debt?
No. No, of course, our interviewer guy, he got the guy I will be interviewing following the end of the podcast. I did give them some change to get their project done. So this band is called Some Nerve. They are from Austin, Texas. They're a hardcore band. I think they have a. I was just kind of looking through their stuff one day. I don't know how, I forgot how I can't, stumbled upon them, but they have a self-titled record come out on Dying Scene Records last year. They got like this really cool kind of modern take on hardcore. I thought it was really good. I'm going to see if I can get a review in sometime soon of it. Cause I think these guys are solid and have a really good thing going. They're called Some Nerve. You can see they're on Facebook, Twitter. You can check the album out on their Bandcamp or dyingscenerecords.bandcamp.com/album/Some Nerve. And the song I'm going to be playing is called Rebellion by Some Nerve off their self-titled album. So here it is. This is Ricky Frankel. I'm here again with Adam White and John Gentile, and we have a very special guest on the podcast. This is Sean Colone. Are you director of the Fat Rat documentary?
Yeah, I'm the director and producer dude.
All right, cool. So where are you calling from?
Guy that started doing it, I guess.
Cool. Where are you calling from?
I'm in Dallas, Texas.
All right, cool. I'm full disclosure, I'm a donor to the Indiegogo campaigns of Fat Wreck. I think it's a really, really great project. I can't wait to see it when it comes out. But we have some questions for you, and I think help the second Indiegogo campaign going. So I was just wondering, how did this?
Sure. I'm totally down. Thanks, by the way, for supporting.
Oh, no, not a problem, man. Not a problem. That vinyl looked awesome, so I had to get it. So how did the idea for the documentary come about? I mean, it's kind of an interesting, definitely an interesting subject, but I'm kind of curious, how the idea kind of happened.
Well, I've been in a band for a while and had a recording studio and did all that stuff and did it for about 10 years. And I was like, hey, I want to start doing some film stuff. So I started shooting some music videos and really just had just started doing stuff. And I did a little making of doc for a music video that we shot. Mm-hmm. And it was for a country music person, and it was cool and it was fun. And I figured I wanted to try something that I really had more of a passion about. And I was like, what do I like? And I was like, well, definitely Fat Records. I've been a huge Fat Records fan for years and years and years. And my friend Joel, one day I was like, hey, I'm thinking about doing a Fat Records doc. You think that'd be cool? And he was like, yeah, that'd be awesome. I was like, cool. Cause there was Netflix is around this time. And so there's a lot more documentaries popping up. And I was like, why is there not a documentary about Fat Records? It's for me, it was something that all my friends loved. It really kind of shaped the direction of kind of where I decided I wanted to do musically with my life. And also there's a certain ethos that was behind it that a lot of my friends and the people that I respected kind of prescribed to. So I figured it'd be a cool idea.
I think it is too. I it's a very fun project, and you guys seem to really be kicking ass. Your first Indiegogo campaign, I think it got 400% the goal or something like that.
When we started, we were just gonna do a little short, like a 20-minute short of talking to people that I knew, musicians and people who were affected by it, from the fans' perspective. Mm-hmm. And so we were just really trying to get a few thousand bucks to go out to California to maybe hopefully maybe get some footage of the Fat Records offices or something like that. And yeah, it really kind of, it was unexpected. I mean, it was expected, but unexpected. I figured it would, the Fat fans would get behind it, but I didn't think it as ferociously as it ended up being. I think we hit our, hit that, we hit $7,500 and we hit that in the first 24 hours.
That's and, crazy.
So it was really like, and then after the end of it, when we hit around $30,000, we decided, man, we, you know, this is, with this amount of money, it's, we can turn this into a feature length thing and really kind of take it and expand on it and do some things that were, you know, more than just a little kind of thing that would go up on YouTube, you know? So it kind of, it's really been awesome to not just the donations of Fat Records fans, but a lot of the making of the movie besides just the financial side. We've had a ton of volunteers helping out with transcribing interviews, donating like their talents as far as like shooting things or motion graphics. Just recently we had we had an interview with John K. Sampson of the now defunct Weaker Thens, but also of Propagandi. And I had a this guy Randy did the interview up there and shot it and did the whole thing up in Winnipeg, and because Fat Records fan, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's really, it's definitely a Fat Records fans effort. You know, I'm kind of leading the charge, but really it's a lot of other people helping out.
That's cool. That's going to make it a lot, I think, a much more special project, since other people are just helping just because they love the label. First of all, why the second Indiegogo campaign then?
Well, we've got like that $30,000 we stretched quite a bit as far as traveling and shooting and those kind of things. And we got the movie, you know, right now we have about an hour and 20 minute edit of the movie. And really to get it out into a more legitimate, you know, into theaters and to do a full distribution, there's a lot of different things that need to be taken care of on the legal side as far as licensing music and getting clearances and all those kind of things. We also wanted to add a few different layers. We're going to be doing this thing with puppets. Jenny Cotterill from Bad Cop, Bad Cop is an amazing artist. And when we were filming with them, she mentioned that she makes puppets. And my head exploded. I was like, we wanted to make it different, but we weren't like searching out a way just to make it different, you know, for different sake. And the puppet thing really came organically, but in order to do it right, because we're going to be using the puppets for like reenactments of things that we don't really have footage for, of some of the stories and some of the things that are going on in the film. And in order to make those, there's an actual physical, like a cost of making them, materials.
Right, right.
And we have a puppet maker and they have to be paid for. There's final color and sound. It'll be mixed in 5.1 for theater. And that takes, you know, someone that has a skill level above my skill level to do. And they're doing it really cheap. We're getting some people to do some stuff for like crazy cheap. But you started out up the money and it was like, well, to finish it, we're at that, you know, what did it say? That last 5% is always the toughest.
Right.
Like we got everything we need less except for a few things. And in order to get it over that hill, we need a little more financial support. You know, and that's including, you know, me and my wife, we put in, since the Indiegogo, we've since put in a bunch of money as well. So it was kind of like, it's in making a movie. And I'll say that if I would have known how hard it was when I started, I might not have taken it on.
It seems like it's kind of snowballed from what you're saying.
Well, it's just, I'm the type of person, if we're going to do something, let's like do it awesome, you know? And in order to really kind of finalize it and make sure it's in theaters, I want people to see it in theaters. I want to see like Fat Records fans together in the theater, seeing it together. You know, I mean, of course we want to have it digitally out on a DVD, but in order to get it into theaters, there's a certain standard you have to hit as far as quality level is concerned. So, One of the cool things is the reason I know all this is because Justin Wilson, he was the editor and director of photography for, or one of the editors and director of photography for Filmage. You guys familiar with Filmage?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was at one point a mentor, kind of giving me a lot of advice and where things need to be. And then he actually came on, and he's actually been volunteering his time too. So it's really the extra money is just to pay for stuff that, you know, we can't get for free, basically.
Right. How did you approach Fat Records in the beginning and get them to? I know it's not the certified documentary of them, but they're obviously very enthused and supportive. So how did you go about approaching them for this project?
Well, to be honest with you, when we started, I really didn't reach out to them directly when I started. Yeah. I just kind of started doing it because I really thought it was just going to be this like small little thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But after we got an interview with Ryan Green, I had I'll just say this: I have a recording studio that I've done for a while, and I had the opportunity to record a track with Joey Cape. It was a cover for one of his when he was doing his solo stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of had a little bit of a funny story. So Joey, we had emailed back and forth about the track. And then about a year later, he accidentally included me on an email thread for Lagwagon.
Yeah.
And I immediately let him know, of course, that he had included me on accident. But in that email thread was Fat Mike's email address.
Nice.
So, but knowing kind of how Mike was and, you know, not being wanting to be one of those guys, I didn't just email him. I just kind of sat on it for a couple years and just kind of had it in my back pocket. And when I did the first trailer, I figured this is the right time. Before I put out something like this into the world, I should at least let him know that I'm doing it or, you know, kind of show him what it is. So I sent him an email saying, hey, I'm working on this Fat Rick Duck thing, and I wanted you to kind of check it out, see what you thought before I'm going to be releasing it tomorrow. What do you think? And he sent me an email back and said, looks cool.
That's great.
As I've come to learn, that's like, man, that was like almost a compliment. all his emails are short like that. He's really, not a long-winded person when it comes to email.
Let's see here. In one of the trailers, I found this kind of interesting. You had Todd Kowalski of Propagandhi, and he talked about how Epitaph and Fat were homogenizing California punk rock, and he kind of seemed like he was being like cautiously negative about the whole thing. And I was wondering, how did you feel about that when he said that in that interview? And were there anyone else that we didn't see in the trailer that kind of had that same opinion?
There's a few people that mentioned that, and I thought it was important to add that in there because one thing we didn't want to do is, even though I'm a huge fan of Fat Records, I didn't want it to be just a fluff piece about how great Fat Records is. They are great, by the way. Making the movie, to be honest with you, it's been one of my biggest challenges was making it not boring because spoiler alert, they treated everybody pretty well and didn't implode really. You know, there's the decline of the music industry where they, you know, but really they fared that fairly well. It's not like some other record labels that imploded or, you know, they don't exist anymore. They still exist. They're still putting out records, and there's everyone we talked to, even the people that had a little beef from time to time, all really cool because Mike is just, when it comes down to it, and everyone over at Fat are just, their philosophy is to treat everybody right. And so, but I felt it was important. I felt that way from time to time. I think the Strike Anywhere, when they got signed to Fat, I was really excited. And the album they put out was really, like, it really kind of got, for lack of a better term, homogenized into, like, that Fat record kind of pop thing. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard that from other people too, you know. When anything becomes really successful and it has a lot of people that are into it, people, and I think, you know, Todd, you'll hear about it in the movie, but to expand on it, it's when something's popular, everyone, you know, I'm one of those guys, you know, I wanted to be in a Fat Records type band. So the kind of music I made is kind of like in that vein. So I think it was a legitimate criticism of anything popular. And I also felt like in the trailer, I wanted to show that we're taking it seriously.
Right.
And it's not just going to be how great Fat Records is the whole time. It's really going to go into the history and some of the stories and some of the, you know, some of the people aren't always going to agree, you know?
Right. You know, that I feel like that's the really fair way to go about it. And it seems a lot more genuine and honest that way. You have like a bunch of awesome, awesome interviews, that in the trailer, that I'm excited to see, but who, you have like Laura Jane Grace, you have a bunch of other Fat Records bands, you have non Fat Records, band members in there, members from like a Wilhelm Scream and Red City Radio. Who are some of the, who can we look forward to just seeing in the documentary that was not in the trailer?
Well, just recently, we had Aki from High Standard. That was filmed over in Tokyo.
Oh, cool.
We just kind of put it out there today just because of the Weaker's Ends thing, but getting John K. Sampson on there, just like I was mentioning before, was probably pretty huge, and I didn't realize how huge it was until I spoke with him. And he doesn't really do a lot of interviews. Like, he's kind of, stays out of that aspect of it a little bit. And it was really great for him to do it. And we also got the guys from Old Man Markley, John and Annie, and who else? There's it hasn't happened yet, so I don't want to say, but we have one more that we should be getting, which was going to be like a glaring hole in the documentary, but until it's in the bag, I don't want to say who it is, but it's somebody that we're told no several times.
Yeah.
And I think at a certain point, people kind of realize that it's a pretty legitimate project, and then sometimes it turned around and said, okay, you know, I'll do it. So I won't say it yet until we have it on film, but there's somebody else from those early Fat bands that we got. And one of the things we tried to do, even though we got a lot of interviews, the main goal is trying to focus on 90 to 99. Right. So, you know, we did get like the guys from Rise Against and that kind of thing, but not everybody from not every single band from Fat Records is going to be necessarily interviewed, of course. But we did get with Pairs.
Nice.
They were in town like days after they signed the contract. I think it was 5 days after they signed. So we kind of got, I wanted to get their, they're still in the warm glow of that initial craziness happening. So I wanted to capture that. So getting to talk to them was really cool. Bad Cop, when we talked to them, they were fairly new at being signed. So I wanted to be able to narratively kind of tie things together. We should be, and we're supposed to be filming at the 25-year anniversary as well, to kind of, in our minds, kind of get that last couple shots of all the bands together and things like that for the kind of the end of the movie. So that'll be really cool, and there may be a few things that get a few interviews that we pick up there that might be unexpected, hopefully. So and Tilt, we got a Cinder from Tilt, by the way. So
great.
The list is pretty the pretty big list.
That's awesome, Sean. Thank you for taking the time out to do the interview. This interview. I'm really excited about this this movie, and I think a lot of people are too. You guys seem to be having really good traction, especially for such a grassroots kind of a film. So let's just end this, and why don't you tell us what Fat Record song you want to play to lead us out of this interview?
Oh wow. It's cliche, but Back to the Motor League.
All right, so here is Back to the Motor League by Propagandhi.
I like to party fucking hard. I like my rock and roll the same. Don't give a fuck if I burn out. Don't give a fuck if I fade away.
All right, so that is it for the Punk News Podcast this week. We're going to see all of you folks in a week from now. So if anyone has anything that they want to get in touch with us about, it's podcast@punknews.org. If you make it to this point in the show, hop onto iTunes, give us a rating there because, you know, we'd love more people to see about this, and that always helps. So anyways, talk to you guys next week.